You are listening to The Reverse Stick, the Global Hockey Podcast. Time now for our feature interview. And this week, we've got our featured interview in the studio. And it's hockey commentator Ashley Morrison has joined us. He's back here in Perth after a whirlwind world tour of hockey tournaments. And we thought we'd drag him in here and just talk hockey. Ashley, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's good to be on the reverse. I know you get upset when I don't say the reverse.
Now, you started your little world tour at the Champions Trophy in Breda. Yeah, went to the World Cup, the Women's World Cup in London, and then you ended up in the Asia Games. And not just calling hockey there, it must be said. What was it, 13 sports?
11 sports in 13 days.
And some of those sports I've never heard of before.
Yeah, it was challenging. I mean, I got thrown skateboarding, which when I remember I had to...
And you're Ollie. I've still got that audio of you talking about Ollies.
I know. Well, the thing was, I thought I'll try and learn some of the terminology and I'll watch that. And I found out there's over 500 terms that they use in skateboarding. And it was, in the end, I just focused on the athletes and their background and their history and, you know, tried to find interesting stories about them as individuals rather than actually trying to describe what they were doing, because I was so limited and so basic in my skateboarding knowledge.
So there was a lot of, oh, that's a great flippy thing. And
totally rad, dude.
Yeah, well, look, it was interesting. I had that. I had rollerblading, fencing, shooting, penchak silat. That was the really challenging one.
Penchak, which is a martial art?
It's a Southeast Asian martial art, mainly predominantly from Indonesia. But just to make it that little bit more complicated, 100 different styles in Indonesia alone.
Yeah, good luck with
that. Not a gold medal for every one of them, though.
No, there wasn't, but Indonesia seemed to win a lot of gold medals and the other countries were not too happy about that. Let's just say that.
Hosting rights.
Bit like boxing?
Yeah, I think sometimes that can happen, yes.
Okay. Let's get back to the hockey, because we're a hockey podcast, and might as well start at the start, the Champions Trophy, which I thought was a brilliant tournament, and you and the commentary team as at London were fantastic and really added to the spectacle for us as viewers. Coverage was excellent. The streaming was fantastic. And the hockey was just awesome.
Yeah, I thought the hockey at the Champions Trophy was amazing. I thought it was really, really good standard. And even, you know, when you look at a lot of people frowned about Pakistan being there, but Roland Altmans had got them organised at the back. Defensively, they were pretty well organised and gave people a tough game. And let's be honest, Australia were lucky to get a win against them in that match.
Oh, they were. And I think that's where... There's now a movement, I think, in hockey where people are understanding that world rankings don't mean that much, and it really came to the fore at the World Cup for the women.
Yeah, and in the final, again, if you look at it again, Australia are an amazing nation. I think we have to give them credit because they were on the back foot throughout that final. India were the better team over the hour without a shadow of a doubt, and then it comes down to a shootout, and Australia just had the coolness and the temperament. And I mean, Jeremy Edwards' finish was very, very cool to win the game for them.
Yeah, well, the Indians don't like the shootout, do they? They've had problems with shootouts recently.
Yeah, it's funny. And I mean, after the Asian Games, I went away and looked at it because I've commentated a lot of games where I've seen teams score the late equaliser and then they win the shootout. So I was like, this happens a heck of a lot. And I wanted to see. So I went back over the last year. And it is in the men's game, I think it's about 70% of the time, the team that gets the equaliser in the last quarter will go on and win the shootout. In the women's, it's slightly less. But over both codes, again, men and women, both genders really, it's still very high. Which makes you think, then, is that fair? Should we go back to extra time? I don't know. But if the momentum swings that much because you've got that equaliser in the last quarter that... If it goes to a shootout, you're winning, or predominantly that team is always winning. I think you've got to look at it.
I would be of the opinion that extra time should be played before any shootout anyway. It should go at least five each way, even if you make it golden goal. And I wonder what that stat would be on golden goals. I bet the team that takes the initiative with that equaliser is probably the team that's...
Yes, more likely to get the next goal on. Yeah, it's just, like you say, it's about the momentum, isn't it?
Yeah,
and,
momentum.
And if your backs are up and you think you've just turned around a losing position into a potentially winning one, then psychologically, there's that benefit, that bonus for you.
Yeah, I think the psychological one's the big one, isn't it? There's that, oh, man, you know,
yeah.
we thought we had it. We had the gold medal in our hand and it's just dropped.
Just talk to Malaysia.
I bet that stat increases the closer that that goal is scored to full time. I mean, if you looked at only goals scored in the last 2 or 3 minutes of a game, I bet that stat is hugely high in proportion to that team carrying on and taking that momentum into a shootout.
Sounds like you're setting yourself up for some homework there, John.
Actually, talking of the shootout, there was one of the things in Brady that was really interesting was the our tournament director came in to the bar one night and he goes, "See anything wrong with this stick, guys?" And we were sitting there and we're like, and it was a left-handed stick.
Oh, really?
And one of the teams had turned up with a left-handed stick for their goalkeeper for a shootout to hold it in the other hand because they were thinking it would throw the opposition because obviously they were expecting. But, of course, because you're not allowed a left-handed stick, it was not allowed to be used in the tournament. But it shows how far people are going to think. And I know Simon Mason, who, as you know, is very much involved with Mercy and owns Mercy and Hockey, he was saying that they had actually been practicing with the goalkeepers with a miniature stick because the rules say that a goalkeeper must just have a stick in his hand, and they were trying to see whether, you know, if you could actually be more effective as a goalkeeper using your mitts and not having the stick if you had just a little stick in your hand.
One of those but he goes, it, autograph.
Yeah, but he said it was an absolute nightmare because it was just so weird and they abandoned it pretty quickly.
Watching the recent tournament, are goalkeepers using a flat stick or are they using the little wiggle stick which sort of
from what I can see they've got different ones depending on the shootout, so they switch sticks for the shootout. They tend to go with a longer stick for the shootout, so they've got a bigger reach.
Yeah, because of course you're not changing your stick mid strokes there, are you?
Correct.
I've always thought that you'd go stick side anyway on something like that because a goalkeeper, if with the freehand side, they can do anything. But when you've got the stick in your hand, it's a different... You know, you try and hit it with the stick, you don't try and hit it with your hand.
It's part of the body, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
The stick. And like, you know, you obviously know, mate, the amount that I put over the top of the bar when I'm in goal with you off the end of the stick.
Luckily, two of them went past you this year. Back to the hockey. The Women's World Cup. No one saw that coming. I mean, everybody saw the Dutch winning, but no one saw them beating Ireland
in the final.
In the final, and no one saw Spain getting close. And mate, and Australia must have been the luckiest team in the tournament to get to where they did. Well, credit to them for managing that, but I don't think they played good hockey at all until they got to the Dutch.
No, I tend to agree. I think Rachel Lynch, as we were talking off air, I think she actually propelled Australia through the tournament, and she has to be, in my opinion, one of the top female goalkeepers in the world.
I think she's the best at the moment.
Yeah, I would agree with you, and I think her form in those games was absolutely amazing. But I thought that what I liked about the tournament was the Italians again. You know, nobody really talked about them because they were the lowest ranked team in the tournament. But of course, they had that opening win in their first game, and then they got through to the crossover games, which was a massive achievement again for them to do that. But again, here was another team where the girls had given up their jobs to focus to train for 3 or 4 months. Now, the interesting thing that I heard from the Irish was that they were saying that one of the things they'd really worked on, because they felt that hockey-wise they could match most of the teams. The area where they were struggling if they played internationals was fitness. Was fitness and that physicality in games. And so that's why they spent so much time working on that. And it certainly paid dividends. And I think Italy proved that. I think Spain proved that. I think Ireland proved that. And to me, these countries, if they don't have the money, we've got to try and get them more hockey so that they can raise that. But it was just fantastic to see.
And that was, for me, the big issue to come out of the World Cup was international fixturings, in the sense you had the Irish coach before the final coming out and saying, well, we've been trying to play the Dutch for 4 years and now they can't avoid us. They have to play us. And I think that's something the International Hockey Federation's got to look at, is the way that certain nations are cherry-picking the nations they play against and just forgetting the rest of the hockey world. Unless we start spreading this stuff out, the teams are never going to improve, because you don't, you know, Ireland didn't lose that final because the Dutch were that much better than them. They lost the final because they hadn't played the Dutch before. They didn't know what they're up against. And when you're playing a really good team like the Dutch, if you play them a couple of times and you know what you're up against, suddenly you're a chance in that. They could have had some tactic worked out.
Well, if you look at, I mean, you go to the International Festival of Hockey a year ago, that was in November in Melbourne. Japan played the Dutch there. Now, the Dutch, okay, they were focusing on the Hockey World League going on in Auckland just after. It was a preparatory tournament for them for that. But in that game, Japan should have taken the lead. It was an awful bit of umpiring. I'm sorry, I don't normally criticise umpires, but it was clearly a penalty stroke. They had a penalty corner. It hit the Dutch player behind the goalkeeper, and for some reason it was awarded as a penalty corner. And Anthony Farry, who was the coach, very calm person, went ballistic at halftime at this particular umpire. And it was hard to justify the decision. But they could have gone 1-0 up in that game. Then the Dutch did take the lead. And again, it was a very, very tight match in Japan against the Dutch. And because, again, they'd done their homework, they were closing them down. But then they got, again, a decision that seemed very harsh, where a penalty corner was given against them for deliberately playing the ball over the baseline. And lo and behold, the Dutch got a second, and then the game was over. But again, there are teams that, exactly what you're saying, John, that can compete with the Dutch, can frustrate the Dutch. And, you know, that's what it's all about, is finding ways to beat them. But if you don't get the chance to play them that often, how are you ever going to do that, apart from watching videos?
And Australia proved that, because they didn't play particularly well during the tournament. But they've played the Dutch enough recently to have systems worked out to take it up to them. And, I mean, that game went to a penalty shootout. Let's not forget, the Dutch didn't win the game. They got through on a penalty shootout.
It's a shootout, John. They don't like the word penalty, the FIH.
Oh, I don't. Can we come up with another word for shuttle?
Shuffle. Call it shuffle, John.
No, I don't like shuffle. I think it's Yeah, exactly. I'm with you, John. I don't like shuffle.
One-on-ones.
I don't mind. One-on-ones, fine.
We could always just go back to strokes.
We could. I prefer the stroke. You know, I think the shootout benefits the goalkeeper. The stroke benefits the attacker.
I think the shootout, what they've got to do is the same rules must apply that in normal play. So if you turn your back as a striker going into the goalkeeper in normal 60-minute play, it goes to the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
So and you shouldn't be allowed to do it in a shootout.
And when the umpire did blow that, they got dumped on by people. I thought, no, that's fair enough. You can't shield them. Nowhere else on the field at any time can you shield the ball.
But I think you know that one of my pet things that I feel the game needs to do, if it's going to progress and it's going to grow and become bigger and we've got the Pro League and all of that, is I believe they need to get in a room, umpires, players, coaches, TV people, broadcasters, even radio, and sit down and go through the rule book and go, do we need this rule, or how can we make it more simple? And rather than leaving so many of the rules interpretive to the umpires, because I don't think that's fair, I think they need to be more black and white and go, if this happens, then this is what the outcome is. Now, the one that gets me is the 5-metre rule with the aerial pass. Like, 9 times out of 10, you could play on. It's not dangerous. The players are not causing danger. So just let it play on, or only blow when danger really happens.
Yeah, you should see how that rule gets interpreted at our grade at times.
But it's so inconsistent at international level. I mean, at the Women's World Cup, there was one game, I remember within 2 minutes, both umpires had interpreted it differently.
Yeah. And we've spoken often about simplifying the rules so that take interpretation out of it. The foot rules are terrible. If it hits your foot, it's a free hit. That's it.
I agree.
Interpretation's an interesting thing, though, because we talked, I think, at the weekend about actually knowing what the decisions are from umpires, and we seem to have lost the art of signalling what the offence was. And so you get frustrated as a supporter or a player because you're looking to see what the decision actually was, and gone, it seems to be, the time where they tap the foot for a foot and arms, you know.
I think the self-pass has caused that, because what happens is play goes on so quickly that the umpire blows, and by the time they've done it, the play's already gone on, so they don't do the signal.
It was happening before that. Signalling had gone out of the game a long time before that, and it is frustrating as a player. All you want to know is what it was for. Oh, what was that free hit for? Because you haven't seen it or something. Well, okay, no worries. Or you might be trying to figure out how the umpire is umpiring the game. Oh, so you thought that incident there was that offence? Okay, if I do that, I can expect to get pinged for it.
Just keeping your arm pointing in the right direction would be nice sometimes. When you get your head up and you think, oh, Christ, which way is it? And before you know it, you're back on your heels and 10 metres off the play.
Yeah. That's a good idea of getting everybody in a room together. I reckon throw in a few litres of beer and sell tickets. That could be a fantastic event.
Well, to be fair, you know, Rugby Union did it in Stellenbosch, where they were 3 days down there, and lovely place. I'm sure there was plenty of red wine flying there, the Pinotage. But, you know, and I'm not saying Rugby Union has got it 100% right, but they worked on a lot of the rules and made it a lot simpler and safer, and that was what they were looking at. But I just think if you get people in a room with a common purpose that is to make it simpler, easier to understand, so that people that are new to the game go, oh, okay, yeah, I get that, rather than not having a clue what's going on,
yeah,
then it's going to grow the game as a whole. It's a fantastic game. It's so fast. It's so exciting. I mean, BT, when we worked with them, a lot of the camera guys came from football, and they all go, man, this game is amazing.
Yeah.
They absolutely love it. And the other thing that they stressed so much is how nice the athletes are compared to footballers. And it's true, you know, we have some of, I think, the most personable athletes in the game at international level going around. You know, they're humble, they're approachable, and they're just really decent human beings.
Is that a product of hockey's lack of professional success on
It may well be, John, but I mean, it's you can probably still nurture that, I think, because there's that history of it. It's been there for a while, and we've not got caught up in the professionalism of sport. So you would hope that even if some money did come in, certainly in the Hockey India League, it was never evident. You know, it was evident maybe in a few players, but I think a few players were just overawed by the swarms of people you get in India as you come off a pitch. And I mean, it literally is quite daunting for some of the athletes if they're not used to it, and they're literally surrounded by hundreds of people wanting a selfie, wanting a photo, just wanting to touch them, you know.
Well, I think one of the beauties too is that when hockey players come back from international duty, they go back to a club where there's mums and dads and these kids. They go back to a real club. They're not going back to, say, Manchester United, that is still so far removed from the people it's purporting to support or represent.
Yeah, they're surrounded by the hockey family.
Yes,
you know, and that's a lot of the times that's what's got them there in the first place, isn't it? It's just before we go off the World Cups and your travels, I'm always interested to know what's going on off the field. The what's the word? The
gossip?
No. I'm talking.
I'm not giving you any of that.
Things around the event, so the venue activation that they like to speak of, so the food trucks and things. What are some of the things that you've seen in most recent tournaments you think work really well and could be replicated in similar tournaments around the world, or even the AHL here in Australia?
Oh, look, I didn't get time to go to the sort of fan village in London because they moved it, whereas before it had always been behind the stand where we were commentating. Because it was such a big event and they put that big stand there, so that it sort of encroached on that land, they'd moved it a little bit further away. And just the way the schedule worked out, I never had time between games to get there.
Yeah.
It was too far to walk. So I think there they had a bit of an issue, and I did speak to some people who had stalls there, and they said it was really hard because it was a fair way away from the venue. The great one in Breda and also in Antwerp when they had it, it was fantastic. You know, like it was literally at the back of the stadium. They had hockey equipment, they had stuff for kids. Breda, you know, they had pictures of the women's team, and you could sit in there on the seat as if you were in the front of the team, and that people were taking photos of that all the time. The food was great, and again, you know, there was music in Antwerp years ago. They would, at the end of the day's play, they would have a band play, and everyone was there having a drink, having a dance, and even, you know, the great thing was the officials were going over there, the umpires, you'd see them, you know, just enjoying the actual atmosphere of the whole tournament. Now, the players couldn't go there at the beginning of the tournament. Yeah. They were there at the end of the tournament. But I think those are the things in it. It has to have that sort of whole village feel, and that it's a place where you can catch up with people, where you can meet people that are like-minded, that love the game, and just enjoy all of that. But it was, I thought Breda did a great job. And I mean, it was hard to believe when they showed us actually the hockey club before they had built the little village at the back and before they built the VIP area, and they were saying how much they had to dig out a whole new trench for the sewage from the VIP area. But it was 6 months in the planning to create this VIP area and their sort of entertainment area for the public. And my hat goes off them because I thought it was really well done.
There was a great photo there at the Champions Trophy too, of they had the setup with all the hockey and rah-rah, and right next to it there's a couple of cows in a field just having a munch on the grass, and all this stuff's going. Would have been a fantastic setting for it.
It was a lovely setting. I mean, I would walk every day. I mean, we could have hired a bicycle, but it was just probably about a mile walk, I suppose, from the hotel. And it was just such
there
a beautiful walk.
There must have been a pie shop between there and
there. No, there wasn't. No. Okay. No. There were good pies when you got to the thing.
Yeah, but they were.
I mean, Bruges? What's big in Holland?
Chips and mayonnaise.
Oh, of course.
Fruits. Chips and mayonnaise. Oh, those little pancake things, profiteroles.
I thought so. Yeah, trying to think of that.
Oh, they're fantastic. Shall we move on? Asian Games. What does it mean to Asia?
Massive. It is huge. I mean, this is the second biggest multi-sport event outside the Olympics.
Okay.
The Asian Games. Just because of the volume of not only countries taking part, but the viewership on TV. There is such a massive interest. And there's a lot of, obviously, kudos if you get Asian Games success in your when you go back to your country. So it was really, really big, and it was surprising how massive it was. I was kind of taken aback at how big it really was.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk, too, during the tournament about the massive discrepancy between the standards of some of the teams involved. And we talked about men and women. There was probably only five sides on either in either draw that were going to be there, and they were five nations. But you know, how important do you think it is that you know, teams like Kazakhstan do get to appear at these tournaments and do get flogged by nations like India?
No, I think again it was if you see those players, it means the world to them. And we've had this discussion before when we look at Oceania, that a lot of these countries to play against India, to be able to go home and go back to their day jobs and whatever and say, I played international hockey against India, the best in the region or whatever. They will live off that forever, you know, and that is a massive thing to have been on the park with a Rupinder Pal Singh, with a Harmanpreet or whatever. And they, if they love the game, that's huge for them. That's as good as a gold medal. And so I think you have to be very careful if you take that away from them, because those moments are still very special, even though they're getting beaten. Now, watching some of the teams, and I was just trying to think, one of the teams who I thought were in the matches, say the men's Thailand team, I thought they were actually quite a promising team. But when you look at, I'd covered them in the SEA Games a year ago. They hadn't played any international hockey since the SEA Games a year ago. And you look at that and you go, they're not playing enough games. Like their whole squad, I think, by the end of the tournament, the most caps anyone had was 12.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole of the Indonesian team were under 10. And then they're coming up against teams where players have got over 200 caps. You know, that depth of experience or the lack of experience, that's really where they're going to fall down.
Well, Indonesia went into that tournament without a world ranking in the men's side of things.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the women were so far near the bottom, it wasn't
funny. Yeah, they were 86, I think, from memory or something.
We had Carl on the show last week from Gibraltar Hockey, and there was a guy there who's played 15, 16 years of international hockey for 40 caps. You know,
well, there was a Thai player who, off the ball, struck another player with a stick. Now, it was bad. There's no describing it. You don't condone that behaviour. We hadn't picked it up in play, and the umpires had followed the ball. It was only then we've got the TV replay, which I believe is given to the technical officials after. I haven't heard whether he was suspended or not, but traditionally, he would get probably 4 or 5 games, maybe 6 for that. And I was going, you give a guy from Thailand a 6-match ban, he's out for 2 years, you know? And so it's like, that's where you've kind of got to look at things and go, actually, you know what, we shouldn't really ban him, but we've got to punish him somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's not acceptable behavior and he needs to learn that. But again, you mentioned Kazakhstan. Let's not forget, they qualified for the Indoor World Cup. Now, they didn't win a game there. But you could see that there were players there that could play. And it was very interesting, you know, and you just sort of think, well, if some of them were given a bit more exposure or they got more games, you just wonder, you know?
What about reducing the number of players on the team? And that's so they could play international hockey well enough, 5 or 6 players on there? Would that be a good idea?
I'm not in favour of that at all.
You heretic.
I'm sorry, I'm a traditionalist.
I'm a traditionalist. Ideas, man. Not a good ideas, man.
No, I didn't say that. Not. So, not a fan of hockey fives, then?
Oh, look, I don't mind that if it's a form of development for young kids and whatever.
Yeah.
I think the indoor game, I think, has a place, definitely. I think if you look again, the way I look at that is Iran. Iran said, we cannot put out a team that's going to compete at 11 aside. But they've had success now with that bronze medal in the indoor game. So hopefully more people will play indoor, which will then create a pool of talent that they can then compete outdoors. Yeah. So I think there's a place for it. And even with hockey fives, you could argue the same. As long as it's going to, the long-term goal is that the, always to me, you should give the kudos is for the 11 aside game, because that is the traditional game. That is the focus. That is what is at the Olympics at the moment, and hopefully will be for a while to come. But to me, that's that. It's like, you know, T20 cricket. That a cap in T20 would mean nothing. A Test match cap would mean a lot more.
Well, just to stir it up even more, then. So, what are your thoughts on winners from Port Vila Hockey Series Open, a fives competition, finding a place in an 11-a-side finals round?
I think the competition's flawed.
Okay, moving on.
Very kind. Matt, you had a few things you wanted to ask us while I was here, because we don't get the opportunity often.
Yeah, I've got a big task at the weekend, Ash. I've put my hand up to live stream a premier game at the weekend, Saturday afternoon, 3:30 local time.
Top class.
It's over 50s men's masters Division 3. It's the grand final. John's going to be taking part, and tonight, like I said, I put my hand up to stream the show. Stream the game. Now, you've got a lot of experience at all sorts of levels of broadcasts, so right up to the big tournaments like the World Cups, down to doing stuff at local level. What are some of the, if I want to do it well at the weekend, what are a few tips for me? First off, with position around the field, and where do I want to find myself with my little iPhone on a...
Well, I can't imagine John's going to be moving too fast, so you're not going to have to...
Well, he hasn't washed his shirt in 3 years, so there'll be a tracker on him anyway. We just got to follow the yellow glow around the field.
So isn't that the Matthew Swan when he was younger, never washed his shirt until he lost? Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's what I'm doing. I could be, if I win the grand final, I'm going into my fourth season of not washing the shirt, because it hasn't been washed since.
Oh my gosh.
So for a novice pitch side, doing it on the most basic of equipment, just on the phone.
Yeah, look, I mean, the best thing is always you're going to be steadier if you've got something holding the camera or your phone rather than your hand, because it's always going to jiggle a little bit there. I would say you need to probably be a little bit higher, slightly elevated, so you again get the whole pitch and it's easier to scan from left to right.
Let me write this down.
Whereas if you're at ground level, obviously it's a little bit difficult
to
do that. But yeah, when we do ours, we usually want to be about 2.5-3 metres above the side of the pitch, if you can. That's not a bad height.
Take a big ladder.
So you say when you do ours, what do you mean by that?
Well, when we do the live stream. So I set up a live streaming setup with a friend of mine who's a cameraman, and we have been doing it for a while now, and the technology's really moved on. And there's no limit to what you can do. So, I mean, for example, we could do replays now, we could do various other things, but of course the minute you do that, you need to have somebody who's a vision mixer that can go back to the replay, and then suddenly you're bringing a third person into the, if you've only got one camera, but then even if you bring in a second camera, suddenly you need a vision mixer, so you're doubling a team of doing it. So, but the technology's moved on, so when we do it, we try to be about 3 metres up minimum, if we're like when we do the rugby, just so you can get that level where you're looking down on the pitch and you're just getting a much better angle to be able to film things.
So it's a decent quality camera that your man's using. Does that feed into your laptop, or what?
So it goes into the laptop. We use a program called Wirecast, and then the key thing, the biggest thing, is your internet upload speed. So it's not a case of the download speed, it's the upload speed, so that you can actually get the footage going up on there quick enough so that it doesn't corrupt.
Yeah.
And then obviously when it's coming out, you can view it better, and it depends on where your internet connection is. But then again, depending on the upload speed, depends on how high you can go with your definition of the footage that you're covering. So we're using a high definition camera. Very rarely will we go to the highest level. Because sometimes we're relying on a 4G modem that we will carry, a portable modem. When some places where you've got a dedicated internet line, it's better to plug that straight into the computer so that the sort of internet is not going to fluctuate. It's going to be fairly consistent, which means you can then assuredly go on a higher definition that you're pumping out your vision.
Yeah. So you're broadcasting via YouTube with this. Have you tried other systems?
Oh, look, we've looked at other systems. The thing is, at the moment, YouTube's probably the better one at the moment to use. For example, if you use Facebook, Facebook has again improved a great deal from when it first started, but it does condense the footage down. So the quality, yeah, it's compressed. So it's the quality isn't quite as good. And then also the good thing about YouTube is YouTube's monitoring of its stats is so much better. So Facebook, if you might have, as you're scanning down your Facebook page and you run your finger or your mouse, depending if you're using a phone or a computer, over that image, they will classify that as a view.
Right.
But you haven't actually watched.
Yes, yeah.
Whereas YouTube, you have to watch for a certain period of time. So even if you watched for 30 seconds, that won't be classed as a view. You have to watch for a longer period, usually than that, especially on a full match stream. And then they'll break down whether someone watched it on a tablet, whether they watched it on a phone, whether they watched it on a laptop or on a TV,
where
they were watching it. They can break down the demographics of the person watching. Obviously, they don't know if it's a room full of people, but it gives you a much better idea of who your actual audience is. So then, for example, as we dropped ads into, you know, the live streams that we do, it's better for that if you're going out there and you can say to someone, look, these were the viewing figures, these are the demographics, it fits your demographic perfectly, so you should be on board.
Is there a charge on using YouTube to put stuff out? So it's free. If I was a local club and I wanted to stream my home games, we could do that as a club, free on YouTube. John, any thoughts on the media side of things?
I got
on the broadcast side of things.
The broadcast side of things. One thing that has worried me a little bit is the numbers that are turning up to watch some of these international hockey events. Not necessarily one streamed by you, but we saw there's been qualification tournaments, etc., where, you know, you've had 100 people watching. A global audience of 100 people.
Yeah, what is considered a good audience?
Well, as far as I'm aware, it's a global audience. Now, it just seems that it's so hard to get any numbers of who's watching at all.
But I think this is the big thing, John, is you can say, we're going to do a stream. And we've done this with various, I mean, we've streamed football, we've streamed hockey, we've floorball, futsal, you know, a number of sports, rugby union. And it all comes down to the promotion. Now, you can set the thing up. If people don't promote it and get the message out there that it's available, you're not going to get the views. You'll get some down the track. I mean, there are some where we've had minimal views on the actual day of the game, and then you go back 2 weeks later and it's suddenly jumped because people were like, I never knew that was available, and they've gone back and watched it down the track. But the key thing is getting the message out. So, for example, if you're saying that you want to stream John's game and Fremantle, the key thing is make sure that everyone in his team knows that you're going to do that.
Yeah.
Share the link with, make sure that everybody in that team shares their link, whether they've got Facebook, whether they've got Twitter, whatever social media out there they've got, bang it out there, because then all of those people in it, the more people that see it, I mean, we tried to do that with one of the rugby clubs we did. They made their whole first team, it was compulsory, they must share the link. And it was amazing how it just, it more than quadrupled the viewing figure by just doing that.
Because I guess people think, oh, it's out there, you know, somebody else will do that, but you've got to take the responsibility.
There's so much out there, and that is the problem. And it's, you know, again, you know, we did the Sultan of Johor Cup last year, and I mean, I shared the links with all of the national associations of all the competing nations. And it was amazing how once they got on board and they were sharing it on a daily basis, this is the link if you want to watch our under-21s play. The viewing figures jumped considerably again after day one and two. So it's just a case of really getting that message out, letting people know it's available. And then I'm a big believer that I think it has to be quality. I mean, I've watched live streams of things, and like you're saying, if the camera's jumping all over the place, or I find some without commentary very difficult to watch because I don't know who the players are unless it's a team I know, and then nothing seems to have context.
I'm the same. I can't stand it. You know, it's hard listening to commentary in another language, but at least it's something.
Yeah.
When it's just silence and the odd.
Well, some of that Spanish commentary is fantastic. Oh, you can get right into it and not have a clue what's going on apart from the goal.
I think one thing I'd like to say about the streaming side of things, and again, I think this is something that is still a sort of. Teething's probably the wrong word, but it's a problem in the early stages. Is people go, I want to stream a game, but what they want is they want TV quality at a budget rate price, and it's like, well, you're not. It's never going to replace TV because TV, the amount of money that goes into TV, the truck alone, you know, is worth where the outside broadcast track would be worth, you know, millions. Yeah. I mean, Hawkeye's van just alone is worth $250,000. So just with the technology they have in the back of that. So, you know, you want Rolls Royce, that's that. But streaming is never going to be that level unless you've got the full sort of top of the tree production.
The amazing thing I find is that you're not going to get that unless ESPN's there or Fox, right? Something like that, whatever, like BT in England. But people have that expectation that that's going to be delivered. But if they lowered their expectations, they'd actually find they're going to end up with a product that is better than what they thought a product at that level was going to be. Because they start concentrating on what you need to do to get that done. And sure, it's not going to have overhead shots. Oh, good. We don't need that. We can plan around that. You know, you don't need all of this extraneous stuff. I think you can probably get away with doing a hockey game with three cameras, and it would be, you could get an equally professional job as you would from BT. You wouldn't get all the extras, but you'd get to see the game just as well.
So with three cameras, how many people would you need to produce something?
Oh, it would depend again with that, because whether you went with GoPros in the goals as being the other two cameras, right. That you could do that, you could set that up, and you could do that with one main cameraman, one vision mixer, and the GoPros are in the goals, because obviously you don't need somebody managing the GoPros. But then if you actually want sort of like a guy with a mobile camera down pitch side who can film the coaches and the reactions on the bench, you know, then you're going into four people.
Yeah.
It just depends on what you want those cameras to do.
I think with the technology moving the way it is, what holds you back most in this area is getting the people to do it. I mean, the technology's there. If you can find a bit of money, you can pick it up for what is now relatively cheap prices. Television equipment was not that long ago horrendously expensive.
Well, you're absolutely right, John. I mean, when we did for example, we had the Australian Floorball Open in Mandurah this year. Mm-hmm. We'd streamed their event, I think it was 4 years ago when it was in Perth. And we were able to charge them less this time than we did 4 years ago because technology had moved on so far that it doesn't cost us what it did 4 years ago to do it. It's a lot easier to do it now. But, you know, so I agree with that. I think the thing I was going to say about, again, the technology is, if you look, we did in Astro Arena in Malaysia, one of the things they did with the broadcast there and the hockey, which I thought was outstanding, was they put a camera in the frame of the goal. So for penalty corners, it was fantastic because you literally were right in the centre of the goal. You had that shot coming there.
And you know, there's not a cameraman wasted there having to do
this. Yeah, it looked fantastic. I mean, they've tried. They, I think, were the first ones to put an umpire cam. They also were, which again, I actually liked that. The umpires didn't like wearing them. Some of them are okay with it now. They're, again, a lot lighter than they were when it was first tried. The other one that I actually quite liked was when they had a goalkeeper cam, and it was optional. I think it was the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup. And it was up to the goalkeepers if they were prepared to wear it. Now, I think three of them said they would and the others didn't want to. But it was a bit annoying because it was on the side of the head. But we did get one save from, I can't remember which goalkeeper, and it was outstanding because you saw the shot coming in. You saw his head turn to watch the ball onto his stick because the camera was on that side. And it was just fantastic because you actually got the whole kind of goalkeeping experience watching it all the way, and a great lesson for kids, you know, to see him turn his head, watch the ball onto his stick to clear it.
I thought you were going to say the ball clipped into the camera and went over the bar. We'll get one on both sides.
Just on this broadcasting thing, is the push back, push off, roll back, whatever you want to call it, the absolutely most boring way to start an international hockey sporting event?
Yeah.
Seriously, as a commentator, that moment, do you not feel sort of there's a sap in atmosphere? There's nothing to it?
I think I get it. Yeah, I do agree with you there, but the one I don't like is the countdown clock inside the stadium, and then there's this, so they go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then there's this pause, then we get a whistle, and then they push it back. To me, if you're going to do the countdown in the stadium, the minute it gets to 1, bang, we're off. You know, we don't need the whistle or whatever. But so that I find even worse. But I get what you're saying, and I've actually been a fan of Bring Back the Bully because it's again, if you look at certain sports, there are things that are unique to those sports. So, you know, like a wicketkeeper in cricket, or if you look the scrum in rugby union.
Yeah, bounce know, down, AFL. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. There are those things. But hockey's kind of got rid of the bully, which was so unique. But I've raised this with a number of the top coaches, raised it with even, you know, people that are involved in the game at that level, and they're going, trouble is the players today don't know how to do it.
Well, that's what, get them back learning. Teach them again. I mean...
Well, we had one in my game at the weekend. Not for a start, but it was one of those ones where we're just going to give it back to the opposition anyway. So one little tap of the stick in there, you can have the ball anyway, mate.
Bully used to be one of the great skills of the game. You know, like in the sense that there were unique individuals that could bully, and you know, you'd have one bloke on every team that was an ace at it, and everybody else would be useless.
Yeah, he's our drag flicker. He's our bullier.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, I think the reason you love it, John, is having been the state's rock, scissors, paper champ, because there is a tactic to it. You know, you're trying
one, two, three,
to, yeah, and you're trying to outthink the guy at the bully, but you know, you love the 1-2-3 thing.
Oh, yeah, that's right, I do.
Just before we let you go, Ash, what's up later in the year for you doing World Cup in India? Men's World Cup?
I would love to, but I haven't heard anything as yet.
Right.
So I'm still waiting to hear. I mean, there's three real major tournaments, I suppose, to come up. There's the Asian Champions Trophy, which is in Oman. And then
there's... That's for the women, isn't it?
No, that's the men's. Yeah.
Okay.
And then
the
Women's Champions Trophy is in China. And then there's obviously the Men's World Cup. I mean, I'd love to be a part of any of those, but yeah, I'm waiting for the phone to ring at the moment.
There you go, hockey fans. Get onto the broadcasters. Get on the FIH. If you want to hear Ashley's dulcet tones commentating your hockey games, you're going to have to get them to employ him.
Yes, do that now. Go and do it.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, well, we look... And this goes for everybody you've worked with in the last... I didn't see the Asian Games because...
I was on my own in the Asian Games. Had no expert
alongside
me. So, yeah, don't panic about that. And when I had Thailand versus Kazakhstan as the very first game, the names were like, thank you very much, guys.
How did you go with that? I mean, that must take up a lot of time trying to get all of that stuff right.
Yeah, it's... That's the hard bit, I think. Trying to identify who's who in a game like that. When you do... sort of international games where it's India or it's England, you know a lot of the players anyway because you've seen them in other tournaments.
Yeah.
So there might be just the one or two new faces, so you soon pick up who they are. But yeah, when you're doing teams that like Kazakhstan, I'd never seen Kazakhstan play before in my life, and so it was like, whoa, okay.
How you go squeezing in some of the names with the flow of commentary?
Yeah,
because some people have long names.
Well, we had a Thai boy playing in our Origin guy playing in our side last year. We can't fit his name on the game card. Like, we can't put Christian name or surname on the game card.
Well, the Thais actually tended to use their Christian names, which made it a lot easier. But I'll tell you a story when I did the Junior Asia Cup and I had a game Sri Lanka versus Iran, and I always remember this. And the director, the Sri Lankans again, very long names.
Yeah.
And so there was a guy, I think his name is Vikram Ramasinghe, and he just had Vikram on the back of his shirt. So I said to my director, I said, look, he's just got Vikram on his shirt. Surely I can just call him that. No, you must use his full name. And I'm going, but by the time I get Vikram Ramasinghe out, it's gone through three other passes. But I had to do it.
And that's just a Christian name, was it?
No, that was his surname.
Yeah.
But no, look, the names can be tricky. And I mean, then you get some, of course, that you think, and I always try and meet the team manager or the coach or someone to go through the pronunciation because you can get caught on those. You know, I mean, the classic was Matt Goads, you know, or Goades. So his wife preferred Goades. He said, I don't care. You know, so it was like, it's his name and he doesn't actually care what it is.
Well, at the Champions Trophy, we picked up another one of them. Was it Nick Irvine at the Champions Trophy?
What was that?
Oh, with a name.
Oh, was it Tyler Lavelle?
Lavelle,
Tyler
yeah.
Lavelle, yeah.
Whereas, you know, no, I've never heard anybody say Lavelle, but it's probably, he knows some bloke from his own hockey club.
Last week we had Carl from Gibraltar on the show. We pronounced Ramage, and Ramage all in the same show.
Yeah,
you go.
And he told me in the preview, and I asked him how you pronounce your name, and he'd said, "Oh, well, for you English people, it's Ramage.
Yeah.
But it's Italian background, so it's Ramage or whatever it was." So where do you go?
Well, I was trying to think when you were saying that, because there was a player in the Asian Games, and I'd asked how you say their name, and I'd written it down phonetically, but it just would never seem to want to come out the way it was meant to. So I go, I meant that, sorry, you know, just not always apologize, but occasionally I just didn't, it would come out the way in my head I saw it, not the way it was meant to be said.
Yeah, I'm terrible for that. If I get it wrong the first time, then even when I've been corrected, I'll then have that double guess going, oh, which one was it again? And then generally go to the original one that I got wrong in the first place. That's just life and norm in general.
I'm sure there's people around this globe that go through their whole life having their names mispronounced by everybody that comes across them. I love names because I've got such a simple one. Seven letters, there's, you know...
And that's both names.
Yeah, that's both names. So I just find names so interesting. I don't know why, I'm a bit of a weirdo. But, you know, imagine going through your whole life, just no one ever calling you by your correct name except your mum and your dad.
Yeah, they should have given you a different name at birth, shouldn't they?
Well, yeah, it's their fault, isn't it? Ashley, thank you for joining us. Been an absolute pleasure. We're going to run out of time with you because... You've got to let you go, and otherwise our whole program will be the Ashley Morrison Show.
Look, thanks for inviting me. Always good to catch up, and I've enjoyed listening to your podcast as well. And I know many around the world are enjoying it, so keep up the good work.
Oh, and give your podcast a plug while you're here.
What, not the footy
not
show?
Not the footy show, which you've been doing for years and years and years now.
Yeah, what is it, 13th year we've been going now?
Now, you do a lot of writing as well. It's available on your blog. Where can people catch up with that?
Yeah, notthefootyshow.com.
Can you just explain to the listeners what the Not the Footy Show is about?
Okay, so what that was in Australia, Australian rules football just dominates all of the sporting landscape, especially here in Western Australia. So came up with this idea of a show where we talk about all sports, but not Australian rules football. And I should just mention, Channel 9, when we launched it, I received a letter threatening us, saying you will cease and desist from using this name because we hold the copyright to the Footy Show. And so I'd actually expected this letter to come anyway, and I registered the name as a business name, where they're pretty strict on what you can and can't have as a business name. So I wrote back to them and said, actually, you know, I've registered this with the Australian government as a business name, and they're very strict on it. And since when do you control the English language? We are exactly what we say we are. We are not the Footy Show. And I never heard back from them.
Well done. Morrison 1, Maguire 0. thanks again for your company, Ashley. We could talk for hours and hours. And if you want to get onto the Facebook, you can talk to Ashley as well for hours and hours. He's up there as well, Not the Footy Show's there. Check it out. It's all sports. And you do a great job for hockey. And on behalf of the hockey family, I'd like to thank you for your work.
Thanks very much. And again, thanks for having me on today.
Cheers, Ash.